So, of course, we are all aware that it's the last day. And we perhaps have mixed feelings. We're happy. We have things to do tomorrow, Saturday, Sunday. But also, we're thinking, what will happen when I go? I like this here, or it's difficult here, but I'm afraid when I leave that I won't take what I have gained. I think I've gained something. How can I apply this in my daily life? It seems so simple and easy here. What will I do when I'm involved in the complications of my life, my work, my family? This is what happens to everyone at the end of the retreat, more or less. And the teacher of my teacher, at the end of a big retreat, someone asked him a question. I have to go home and I have to deal with my wife and my children and my job, and tomorrow I will be back in it. What can I do? And he said, if you do not want to leave the zendo, this room is called in Zen terms, the zendo, the practice room. If you do not want to leave that room, do not ever enter it. Now, this is a very interesting response. And often when this teacher, the teacher of my teacher, when he says things like this, it looks like a joke. It sounds like a joke. The way that he says it is, if you don't want to leave, don't enter. It sounds like something funny, and everyone laughs. Huh? Isn't it good? You can hear him saying it. And everyone laughs. And the depth of that statement is lost in the laughter. On the one hand, we can say, he's saying, okay, fine. If you don't like leaving here, well, then you shouldn't have come. Because by coming, you knew you had to leave. That's one perspective. Another possibility is, okay, if you don't want to leave, don't leave. Stay. Stay in the zendo. Well, how can I stay in the zendo? I can't live in this room. It wouldn't be possible. We can enlarge that to mean in this place where we are, this retreat. And a lot of people try to live in retreats. They go from one retreat to another. And some choose a monastic practice where they go live in a monastery where there is constant formal practice. Because they think that they don't want to leave that place. And so they're not leaving. Another possibility is, when he says, if you don't want to leave it, don't enter it. Meaning, don't create the difference. Don't say, this is the practice and this is not. This is some special existence and this is not. this is practice life and this is everyday life. As soon as we make that difference, then we have to leave and come and leave and come and leave and come. Of course, there is a difference. And it's important to recognize that there is a difference. When we arrive in retreat, the Japanese word for retreat is sesshin. And this means, it can be translated as sort of a gathering of a bringing together of the heart. And we can interpret that as all of us doing it together, but we can also interpret it as individually, I am, the first part, shin, means heart-mind, which in most Asian languages, they don't distinguish the two. In Western languages, we have the mind and we have the heart. But in most Asian languages, they don't have that separation. So shin is that, it's heart-mind. And the first part of it, sesh, is the gathering part. It's the putting in order, it means putting order. Not in a sense of controlling it, but sort of if we had spilled a box of matches and then we gather the matches all up together into one. So it's making one. It's bringing it all together. An image we can use is like a turtle. Do you know what a turtle is? It has its legs, its tail, and its head that are outside the shell, and sometimes it brings them all inside. Well, the retreat, the sesshin, is the equivalent of bring the turtle, bringing everything inside. We bring everything inside, we leave our busy place, our activities, our usual occupations, worries. We bring it all inside and we are here in this place where we don't have to really think about much. In fact, we try to create a schedule so that you only have to think of one thing at a time. When you're eating, you only need to eat. When you are serving, you only need to serve. And this is why the servers, they are entirely serving the food, and then when they're finished serving the food, then they are eating. And when we are eating, we're completely eating, and when we are all finished eating, then we wash the dishes. One thing at a time. When we sit, the only thing we need to do is sit. And even, you know, you hear a sound, and immediately we hear the car going by and we think what kind of car it is. We think where it's going. And that reminds us of, oh, when I was going there, I did this. Or I think of my car, oh, I need to clean it, or it needs to be fixed, or I need to get my driver's license renewed, or something that has nothing to do with the car. Instead of just car. And that's why when I gave that practice of identifying it in a language I can't speak, it helped me to free myself from following that car and going off somewhere else. The one activity is just sitting. That's all we need to do, and if there's a thought, there's just a thought. We add on other activities very quickly. But this, by practicing intensely like this, little by little, we let go of those other activities. So I don't know if you can feel it, but it's very powerful for me to sit here now. everyone is here. You can feel the presence in this room. Of course, there was a presence in the beginning as well, but it's not the same as it is now, because everyone is really settled. You maybe don't feel it, and everyone is settled in their way, but it's not the same as it was on Friday night, or on Sunday, or on Wednesday. It's different. Every moment is different. Now, of course, when the turtle puts its legs back out, something else happens. The turtle usually brings its legs in because there is a danger. I'm not sure if a turtle sleeps with everything entered and does anyone know? Yeah, it sleeps with everything pulled in?
Yeah.
But when it needs to eat or walk or swim or drink or whatever it does, the turtle, when it goes about its daily life, it puts the legs out and the head out and the tail out and it moves. Which is what we do too. When we leave this gathered heart mind, we go to do something else. Can we take, for the turtle, the shell is the zendo. Can we take that with us? Of course we can't. If we tried to carry this house on our back, we'd be in big trouble. But we are our house, so we always have our house with us. Which reminds me of when my son, who is now 12 and a half, was a tiny baby, and I was living in a community, a practice community. It was not monastic, because we had families and wives and things, but with my teacher, and it was a small community. There were only five or six of us living there. But in that, it was like here in the upstairs room was the practice place. And so people came from outside to practice. And there was, every morning there was sitting, every evening there was sitting, and one weekend a month. Well, I had a tiny baby. And anyone who has had a tiny baby knows that babies don't follow a schedule like this that we have. And even if they do have a schedule, it's not this one. As a mother, I had to follow my baby's schedule. When my baby needed to eat, I needed to feed my baby. When my baby needed to sleep, I needed to put him down to sleep. When he needed to, his diaper changed, I needed to change it. So I couldn't follow the schedule like everyone else. I couldn't, in the morning, I also had another child, an older child who was going to school. So I had to be with my children in the morning before the one went to school and the other one who was up long before, and the normal life of a mother with children. Everyone else in the house and the other people coming from outside was sitting upstairs all together. When I had finished my activities and was ready to sit, they were finished. So I spent a lot of time by myself, sitting by myself, and with my family, my children, because my husband was around, but he was working, and if he was there, we could trade. Sometimes he would sit, and sometimes I would sit. And this was very, very painful for me, very difficult. And sometimes I would sit, and my entire sitting was crying and crying, feeling so separate, feeling so outside of the practice, feeling so alone. Until one morning when I'm sitting there crying, and I can see the mothers are moved by this experience, because you recognize it probably, and I am moved to remember it. Until one morning when I was sitting there, and suddenly it occurred to me, wait, I am always in the heart of my practice. What am I thinking? I'm outside of the practice. What am I thinking? They are excluding me, or I have to exclude myself because of my children. I'm always in the heart of my own practice. I can't be anywhere else. This is my practice. Everything I'm doing is my practice. I can't say that all of my problems were solved, but that issue no longer had the same power. I can't say that I no longer always, I still wanted to be sitting with them, and I still wanted, whenever I had occasion, to sit with them. But I also became much more free, and whenever I had the opportunity, when my son was sleeping, then I could sit. Or at night, when I would put my daughter to bed, who was older, everyone else was sitting upstairs, I sat next to her bed while she was going to sleep. She loved it. Her mother was sitting there with her, not doing anything special, but entirely present. I was completely there, just sitting next to her. And it was something that I could count on. I knew every night I had to put my daughter to bed. And so I knew every night I would sit. And that became my schedule. That's my path. Every night when my daughter went to bed, and in the morning after everyone was gone and my son had been up and eaten and then went down for his morning nap, I would sit again. The rest of the time, I was doing whatever I had to do. But that also was my practice. And I say to everyone, often, I could not have done all of the practice all of those years without my children, without my family and that structure that I had. It was so powerful, such a support for my practice. So you see, it reversed from being something that was preventing me from practicing to something that was my practice and that allowed me to develop my and deepen my practice in a way that I think I could not have done otherwise. I say that, but of course we don't know because that's how it was. Someone else has another practice. My brother in the practice, who is also a successor of our teacher. He was living in the community with me. He had a completely different. He had no children. He was not in a relationship. He had no job. Totally free. He could sit whenever he wanted to. When at the time our teacher traveled like this, and she went to different countries and did retreats and things, he went with her all the time. I could never go. I used to sometimes think, oh, he's so lucky. His is so much better than mine. It's not fair. Mine is so much more difficult. And then, at some point, I realized, well, no, actually, mine was much easier. I didn't have a choice. When the opportunity presented itself, I had to take it. I couldn't think, oh, maybe I'll sit now. Oh, no, maybe I won't. He could do that. He could pick and choose. That's how I thought. If he were sitting here, he might tell it differently. But that was my experience. his practice was his practice, my practice was my practice. He had other issues. He didn't have any money. He had to struggle. He had to find work. He was Belgian, and he was living in Paris. He had left his wife in Belgium as a teacher to come and live in Paris, and so he had different struggles. He had to scrounge and find jobs wherever he could, painting houses and I don't know what. For both of us, however, that was our practice. Whatever our life was, that was our practice. We learned to not enter or leave the Zenda. It was everywhere. Every place was the Zenda. So there was no question of leaving or entering it. Of course, we recognized, and still do, that there's formal practice, there are retreats, there are weekends, we come together to sit. He has a community, a Sangha in Belgium, with regular activities. Of course, we recognize that. But the reason that we can do that is because we have recognized that our life is our practice. Everything we do is practice. And we come to that realization by formally practicing, by sitting down and just doing this. This training of just doing this, which is not doing anything. We're not doing anything, actually. I say that with those words because that's how we communicate what I'm talking about. But that's not what it is. We're not doing anything. So this, when I described the shift that I made, I had to suffer a lot before I could make that shift. And I had to just keep doing it, even through the pain, and sitting there day after day crying about it. I had to just keep doing it. And eventually I could drop my ideas and therefore experience something different. But in order to drop the ideas, we have to just keep doing it. And when something presents itself, boom, then we see it. And then the moment is right. We can't make that moment happen, but we can cultivate the ground so that it has the possibility of happening. And cultivating the ground means being open. And that always reminds me of the story, the Japanese Zen master in America, Suzuki Roshi, who's quite famous, and wrote the book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which is a classic, wonderful book. One of his students tells a story that the student wasn't particularly close with Suzuki, but had been around him and practiced for some time, and at one point he was asked to take Suzuki to a doctor somewhere. It involved driving for a long distance, and on the way home they decided to stop and have some lunch. And the student was a strict vegetarian. You know, so what? It is, but it isn't. So, a strict vegetarian, you know, like vegan, no cheese. Oh, no, I think he did eat cheese. No, he did eat cheese. But otherwise, strict vegetarian, and was very, very meticulous about it. And constantly was, everyone knew about it. even Suzuki knew about it, even though he wasn't very close with Suzuki. And for him, in the retreats and things, it was vegetarian food, and so he just thought that, well, that was the way. The way was to eat vegetarian food. Couldn't conceive of anything else. So they stopped for lunch, and so he's trying to find a restaurant that has good vegetarian food or something appropriate, and he can't really find it, and he's worried because he thinks that that's what Roshi, that Suzuki Roshi wants as well. And Suzuki Roshi is just following along. And they stop, and Suzuki Roshi stops in front of a place, and it's what in America we call a diner, which is one of these, you know, maybe the equivalent of just a cafe in a village somewhere. Nothing special. Very ordinary food. And Suzuki said, oh, this looks like a good place. And I thought, oh, no, you know, well, okay, if he wants to eat there, I have to go there with him. So they went. And they sat down, and the guy was looking at the menu, and there was really nothing he could eat except a cheese sandwich, a toasted cheese sandwich. And what am I going to eat? Okay. So the waitress comes and he orders the cheese sandwich. He thinks Suzuki Roshi will order that too. And Suzuki Roshi said, I'll have a cheeseburger. What? Okay. And he said, are you sure, Roshi? Are you sure that's what you want? Oh, yes, yes, that sounds really good. Yeah. Cheeseburger.
With an
M. What? Probably in America, in a diner, they didn't serve beer. But. And so, okay, fine. So the waitress brings the food. And we start eating. And Suzuki starts eating his cheeseburger. And the guy eats his cheese sandwich, starts eating his sandwich, and Suzuki said, how is it? And the student said, oh, it was good. It's okay, actually. Fine. And the student said, how is yours? And he said, oh, it's good. It's good. And he said, can I try yours? Suzuki said, can I try yours? And the guy said, yeah, sure, fine. And so he took a bite of it. Suzuki took a bite of it. Oh, yeah. Yours is better. I took it. And gave him the cheeseburger. And Suzuki Roshi ate the whole sandwich. Mm-hmm. So the student was stuck with not eating or eating the cheeseburger. Which went against everything that he believed in, everything that he was so attached to, every idea that he had about right and wrong, and good and bad. Meat was bad. Not only was it bad to eat it for some sort of principle of not killing, but it was bad for him. Bad for his body, all sorts of ideas and whatever that he had. Now, do you remember the? Did he eat it?
The way I remember it, he ate it.
Yes, that's how I remember it too. But that, I thought that might be just my fantasy.
Yeah, that's. I'm not sure if it's my fantasy.
I think he eats it. And now, as Miriam said, it's outrageous, the story, but. In a sense, it's not outrageous at all. It's the teacher having so much care for the student that he wants to help him free himself from his limitations. He's very limited, this student, by his ideas. Not only his ideas about food, but his ideas about himself and the world and other people. And what the practice is. For him, part of the practice was eating only vegetarian food. Here we eat vegetarian food. partly because it's traditional, but also because it helps. There are some foods that favor active mind or heaviness or that we are attached to that create a certain dependence. You know, that's like coffee and tea and things like that we try to stay away from. Sugar. And meat is one of them. Something very heavy. Something. But there's no rule in the sense of not eating meat. That's just how we do it here. So, now why did I tell them? Oh, yes, it's like being open. So when you leave here, to some extent, you will find it easier to be more open. You will see that your awareness is heightened. You can feel sometimes as if you don't have any skin. You've lost some of the skin that you usually cover yourself with. And that can be frightening. I need to protect myself. I'm like a turtle, you know, I need to have a shell around myself. And that's true. We do need some of that to function in everyday life. But can we be aware of what is the right amount? What is necessary in terms of protecting, and what is too much? Or what is not enough? One of the first retreats I did when I left, I was on the train going in England, and I was going back to London on the train, and I had the feeling that they seemed so uncomfortable. Everyone in train, it's a train that was taking people to go to work in London in the morning, and they all seemed so uncomfortable and just a general discomfort, like their clothes didn't fit right or something. I had never seen this before. I'd never noticed this before. And I was not very experienced or aware, and so I didn't know even what I was seeing. Later I came to understand that what I was seeing was this general discomfort of the human experience, what the Buddha called suffering. But it's more this unease, or discomfort when we are separate from who we really are. And it's true. We could say our clothes don't really fit right. We're not really one with who we are. We're uncomfortable. Something's not right. And I was able to experience that because I had so intensely dropped off things during the retreat. I didn't know that. I had no idea that's what I was doing. I had no, and while I was in the retreat, I didn't know that. But when I went out, then it became more clear. I cannot say that I am that I experience that every moment, and of course it dropped away, and I didn't always see that. But that experience does not leave one. Then I have seen that, and I know that. And I always have access to that at every moment. At every moment I have access to seeing things as they are. We all do. I'm not saying I in a personal way. I'm saying we all have that possibility. If we don't create the separations that we normally create. I also don't want to make it sound like it's possible to go out into the world, and even speaking of it in very out and in dualistic terms, I don't want to make it sound like it's possible to go out and feel exactly like you feel now, and to experience going to the supermarket and talking with your partner or going back to work in the same way that you are experiencing things now. There are different circumstances, a different situation. And you are called upon to do different things. It's just like when I'm eating, I'm called upon to eat. When I'm sleeping, I'm asked to sleep. When I'm sitting, I'm asked to sit. Same in the rest of life. There are different tasks and different things. Can we have the intention, maybe, of bringing the same awareness and presence to all of our activities? It doesn't matter if we fail or succeed. It's not about failing or succeeding. It's just having that intention, maybe. That desire, maybe. Aspiration. And even to even have the aspiration to bring that awareness to when we don't have it, when we're confused, when we're lost, when we're caught up in it. Then we're just caught up in it. We don't try to be anything else. We have no expectations in that sense. When we sit at the table for a meal downstairs, we have no idea what will be presented to us. Unless you help cook the food or you're the server, most of us, we have no idea what they are going to bring and put before us. We've become sort of used to breakfast. There will be some sort of fruit and some sort of cereal and some tea, but we don't know what that will look like, what it will taste like, how much there will be, what color it will be. And we probably, maybe you do have some expectations, but you've managed to more or less let them go. In the beginning, you would like to have had coffee at breakfast, but you let it go. And yet tomorrow you will be very happy when you have coffee at breakfast. It doesn't, your detachment from your desire does not mean that you can't appreciate it when it presents itself. We have this idea that in some people have the popular image of Zen is that it's detachment, no feeling, passive, cold. It's the complete opposite. It's you truly enjoy whatever is there when you enjoy it. And you truly are sad when you feel sadness. And you truly are lonely when you feel lonely. But you don't carry that loneliness into your happiness. Or you might, but then you're just experiencing that. And when you're just experiencing that, then there's no carrying over. Just that. Having said all of this, I would also say, tomorrow when you leave, be kind to yourself, be compassionate, notice your difficulty if you have it, notice your wanting to stay focused, you find yourself not able to stay focused, notice this, the part of yourself that wants that and is not satisfied with that. And be kind to that aspect. And be kind to the aspect that is getting caught up. And say to yourself, oh yes, I see this part of me is getting caught up. see it and I have some compassion for it because it's getting lost. So be kind and gentle to yourself, and also be kind and gentle to other people. You know, you may become angry because your partner is behaving like he always behaves. Or, you know, the world is as it was, you know. Okay, you know what it feels like to be like that. You know what it feels like to be caught up, to not be settled, to be busy with the loud noises in the morning. You know what that's like. And so you can be kind and gentle and understand, be open to it, and understand what that's like. Because it's your experience too. You know that. You know the quietness, you know the silence, but you also know the noise and the busyness. Now also, there's always the question of, okay, then how can I maintain the formal practice? And we discussed this yesterday, and we were discussing in the future, when will I come back, or what various activities. Each of us can do it ourselves as well. Like I said, when I had, and I was even living in a Zen community, and I still had to do it myself. We each have to do it ourselves, no matter what. So, every morning you had to walk up here yourself and sit down. And you had the choice. You could have stayed in your bed, but you chose to come up here and sit. No one would have gone and pulled you out of your bed and said, come here and sit. You sit. You were supposed to know that after all these years. So we each do it for ourselves as well and find when it works for us. As I gave my example, it worked for me to sit next to my daughter's bed every day. That was a moment that I could count on. That was part of my schedule that never changed. Exceptionally, it did when she was with her, I was divorced from her father, and so when she was with him, that didn't happen. Or, you know, other moments, but generally I knew that I could count on it. And I did it for a certain amount of time, and I did it every night. And we all can find something like that. We all can find a moment in our lives. If we want to, if that's what we want to do, we will find it. I recommend, from my experience, instead of giving yourself, you know, a huge book, War and Peace, which is like giving yourself, solving all of the problems in the world, right? Instead of giving yourself that big, huge chunk, give yourself a small, you know, a book that's 50 pages, 10 minutes, you know, three times a week, I don't know, 5 minutes every day. 20 minutes twice a week, 10 minutes twice a week, I don't know. Whatever fits in your schedule, keep it realistic. What will I really do this? You know, if I say I'm going to do it a half an hour every day, will I really do that? Might be difficult. Might not. Find a time that works for you, a place that works for you. Look at your schedule and see what seems appropriate, you know, when not too many people are around, when you won't bother anyone, when no one will bother you. With small children, that was not always easy because there was one always coming into the room and wanting something. So figure out whatever it is that works. And then stick to that. Give yourself that as a frame in which you can be free. And if you've said, I will do 20 minutes, then you do 20 minutes. You don't do more and you don't do less. And then you're done. And you move on to something else. That's you. That's when you're sitting, you're sitting. When you're not, you're not. If you have the possibility to sit with a group as well, with other people, do it. It's a big help. It can be a real support for your daily practice. Or if you don't have, if you're not able to do it yourself on your own, it can be a support to have that. You know, once a week you'll do that, at least. Even if it's one or two people. It's a support, it's a help. Because then you support each other. You know, you give your, you, the other one can count on you, and you can count on the other one to be there, to do it. And if you don't want to do a regular practice, then don't do one. Don't oblige yourself, don't require yourself to do something if that's not what you want to do. Because as soon as you start making it, you know, I feel guilty if I don't do it, she will think I'm bad if I don't do it, the other people will think I'm bad if I don't come. You know, look at it. Look at what's my responsibility? Do I really want to do this? And if I do, I will. Of course, sometimes you can't. You have a meeting. You have to stay home with the children. You have to work. Sometimes you can't, right? And that's legitimate. It's important to look at what your desire really is. What is my, what do I really want? Am I doing this because I think I should? Sometimes you don't even know why you're doing it. That's fine too. You don't have to know why you're doing it. The importance is doing it. It doesn't matter if you know it, just do it. Are there any questions? Often at the end like this, people have questions about, mostly about going out and leaving, but if there's anything else or about what I've said, or something that I've said before earlier in the week that raised questions?
My mind is working very fast in the morning and not so fast in the evening. What do you think of the time for thinking?
Well, the best time is always now. I mean, that's the absolute answer. But it's important for you too to sort of figure out what is best for you. And it might be best for you when you're very busy in the morning, when your head is busy in the morning, to sit. That might be better, because then you can see how your mind is going about. It might be better to sit at night when your mind is more settled, and then you're more settled. I don't know.
Yeah. Can I do this meditation?
Can I
do a meditation alone? know without lots of people behind. That's me around me, and
you can, but it's extremely difficult. And the great Tibetan master Shogyam Trungpa, who was this wild and crazy guy who came from Tibet to America, and when he came to the West, he took off all of his Tibetan stuff and all of the forms and everything, and he just had people just be Westerners and practice in a very Western way. And they had all sorts of problems, you know, they had jobs and houses and mortgages to pay and insurance payments and car accidents and all the stuff we all have in our daily lives. And they wanted to get rid of all of that. And he said, you know, you think these great Tibetan masters, it's so much better the way that they practice and so much easier, and that's true in one sense. And he said, but actually your practice is much better, because if those great Tibetan masters had to practice like you practice, they would have the same problems you have. And he said that the most difficult practice of any would be sitting in the middle of the freeway in Los Angeles and trying to practice. So you can make it difficult for yourself, or you can make it easy. And you can make it easier by choosing a quiet place and a time when there aren't many people around and you won't be distracted. You can limit the distractions. But you can do it in the middle of the freeway in Los Angeles. That you can, but it's very difficult. Very, very difficult.
How many
times a week or a day?
You
have to decide that for yourself.
One time.
Fine. If that's what works for you.
Time also.
If it doesn't have to be the same time every day, but you, because your schedule is different every day, most of us, you know, so you know that on Tuesday at 8 p.m. you can do it. And maybe on Wednesday at 8 you can't do it. And on Thursday you can do it at 7 in the morning, but on Friday you can't do it at 7 in the morning. So make your schedule and then stick to it. On Tuesday you do it in the evening, and on Thursday you do it in the morning. And stay with that. Open. Always open. Yeah. Because with the eyes closed, we can become lost in ourselves. We can be caught up in this me, my thoughts, my dreams, my anxieties, my emotions, whatever. We can also fall asleep quite easily. And falling asleep literally, but also falling asleep in the sense that we're no longer interacting in the world. We're asleep to the world, not awake. When we have our eyes open, and it's not open fully and looking straight ahead and looking at everything around me, because then we become caught up in the outside. We become distracted and interested in all and everything that we're seeing around us, and we're no longer aware of this. Or we're aware of this only as it is interpreting what we're seeing. So we choose, of course, the middle way, which is the eyes not completely open, not completely closed, and not looking straight ahead or around. Looking, not even looking, the eyes are just, the gaze is just resting on the floor. You know, a meter or so ahead. I'm not fixing on one point, I'm not looking at anything in particular, I'm just resting my gaze there. Now I am not cut off from the world, it's important to be aware of what's around me, the other people, the light, the colors. That's the reality. And I'm not cutting myself off from this reality by becoming caught up in the other, the outside. So this is the middle way of not inside, not outside, not eliminating one in favor of the other, just the middle way. Sometimes that can be distracting too. So sometimes I will close my eyes for a few minutes just to come back, remember, okay, coming back here, and then I will open them again. However, it can be tricky because as soon as we close them, we want to stay there usually. There's a very strong temptation to want to keep the eyes closed. So as much as you can, maintain that the eyes half open, half closed, and just gazing. Try to resist that desire to close the eyes and stay here. And that's what I said, like when I sometimes close my eyes and return, that's what I mean. And it's important to experience that, to recognize what you're describing. And the only way that you can experience that is that you do one enough to get to that point where you notice that, and so then you return. But then it's important to go back to it. What's important is not being stuck somewhere, right? It's like coming off the pole again. And generally, we are stuck with the eyes closed. So it's important to not, when we realize, as you practice more, you gain more experience, and you have to trust yourself and say, okay, yeah, I'm stuck here with my eyes closed. I need to open them again. And then if you find yourself stuck, you know, we might be stuck with an idea of what it is to have the eyes open. Or we might be stuck with some idea of what we should be experiencing, and we're not. So then, look at that, and jump off the pole again, whatever the pole is. It's important to have a basic posture, a basic ground on which to sit ourselves, right? And so part of that is the eyes open. You can modify it according to your needs in any given moment. Returning to the basic ground. It's important just to be aware of why I'm closing my eyes and why I'm opening them.
Sinto muito bem neste ambiente
feel very good how in this Buddhist context.
Tal como se sinto bem no ambiente católico.
I also, the same way, I feel very good within a Catholic context.
E também me sinto bem no ambiente hindu.
And I also como feel very well in a Hindu.
Em palestras onde se fala do livro dos Shivas. Às vezes fico um bocadinho baralhada e acho que não sigo um critério e que o devia fazer ou não, porque tento criar um procurar algo ou melhor, encontrar o melhor de todas estas vertentes.
What I'm trying to do is I try to find, take the best from all of those different things.
Para encontrar algo que eu procuro.
To find what I am looking for.
Porque todas estas filosofias,
because all these philosophies
têm aspectos muito bons para mim.
They have very, very good aspects.
E consigo me identificar com todas elas. O problema está quando eu tenho que se eu tenho uma prática católica, como é que eu estou a meditar com a imagem do Buda? Às vezes é difícil para mim fazer esta separação, mas faço. Só que torna-se muito difícil dizer o que é isto. Parece que não sou coerente com os meus princípios. E efetivamente sou e gosto, porque em todos eles eu sinto-me bem. Gosto por um lado e por outro lado gosto de sentir esta liberdade de não estar, digamos, presa a uma via. Portanto, baralho-me, porque se por um lado gosto desta liberdade, por outro lado estou aqui no domingo vou à missa.
That doesn't seem weird to me at all. That doesn't seem strange. We have in our lineage, in our the greater lineages, my Zen family, some of the other teachers, there is a priest, a Catholic priest, and several nuns. And there was also a rabbi and a Sufi Sufi imam. There are a lot of the teachers who are from Jewish backgrounds, who are not rabbis, but they're from Jewish backgrounds. There are Miriam and I, our teacher was a very devout Catholic, when she was young, and still is very attracted to all of the Catholic. I wouldn't necessarily say the rituals. It's not so much the rituals that attract her, but she's inspired by
the Catholic music.
Some of them, yeah. So Zen, in that sense, has no problem with. Doesn't even, I was going to say, has no problem with mixing, but it's not even considered mixing. It's you in this practice, you just manifest yourself as you are, and if you're a Catholic priest, that's what you manifest as a Zen teacher. If you are an American woman who lives in Paris and has two children and is a writer, that's what you manifest as a Zen teacher. And each practitioner is the same way. I understand, however, the difficulties that you can experience. Something that has helped a lot of us, not necessarily me so much because I didn't have another religious tradition that I was coming from, but a lot of people do. And we at one point did a retreat at Auschwitz, the camp Auschwitz. And there were 150 people from all over the place. And it was arranged so that every day, all day long, we sat on the tracks where the trains arrived, and the people were taken out of the train cars. The selection was made. Some were sent to die, and some were sent to work, which also meant they would die. We sat every day out there. And it was wintertime, and it was snowing. It was very intense. And each day during the day, there would be in four corners of the camp, there would be a ceremony, a service. The Catholic priest would do a mass. The Buddhist, one of the Zen teachers, would do a Zen ceremony. Sometimes there was a Tibetan, and she would do a Tibetan ceremony. The rabbi would do a Jewish ceremony, I forget exactly what we did. And the Sufi imam would do a ceremony. And we could choose which one to participate in. And then also each day, everyone would participate in one. So one day it would be the Catholic priest who did it, the next day it would be the Zen priest, whatever, different day. And what we came to realize was the only thing that we all had in common was our differences. And that each of us, each of these ceremonies was about the same thing. The rituals were all about the same thing. Of course, they had different words and it looked different. You know, there were we could have a lot of disagreements if we were stuck on our ideas about it. But there was no problem. Everything was welcome. Everything was bringing us to this place of fullness, of nothing missing, nothing outside, no separation. We even, at the end of this retreat, my experience was there was a Vietnam veteran there, someone who had fought in the war in Vietnam, which was a horrible experience for the American people, but also for the soldiers, and for the Vietnamese people and the soldiers. And this American man, he said to us at one point, "We're looking at the ground, we're looking at the places where the people were died, where they had to live in these horrible conditions. We're looking at the fences around." He said, "Look up. Look up to the guard towers. There are still these towers where the guards were." And he said, "When you go to the execution wall," all of us were standing against the execution wall and trying to see what it would feel like to have been facing a wall where they were going to shoot you. And he said, "Go to the spot where the guns were. Stand there and look from there." That is really an interesting perspective, which we don't normally have. We're stuck on our perspective of the people who died, these horrible victims, these soldiers, these Nazis. They were awful. They did bad things. But when you look up there and you think, and you're experiencing this wholeness, you see that the guards and the executioners were no different than us, and that we all have that potential as well. And we could feel, I could feel the suffering that they must have been experiencing if they could make someone suffer to the extent that they did. Of course, they weren't aware of it. If they were aware of it, they wouldn't have done it. If you're aware of causing someone pain, you won't cause someone pain. If you're aware of the preciousness of life, you won't kill. And it's this unawareness that is so painful. I tell this only as a means of showing the wholeness, that everything can be included, and it's entirely possible to sit here one day and then go to the church the next day. And there's no contradiction in your heart, in fact. There might seem to be a contradiction in the forms of the aspects of it, but there isn't in your heart. Christ and the Buddha had the same message. And Muhammad and any, you know, you name it, they all had the same message. Of course, it looks different. The Catholic priest says it in a different way, and he manifests it in a different way. But like I said, he is in the same lineage as me. When we all meet as teachers in this Zen lineage, we are all sitting together in a circle, totally equal. The Catholic priest, the nuns, me, the rabbi, the men, the women, the Americans, the Poles, the Germans, the Dutch, we're all sitting there together. We just manifest it in a different way, but it's the same. And we have people, you know, I'm often very inspired by St. Teresa or St. John of the Cross or the mystics, for example. Yeah, I'm much more inspired by the mystic tradition because it's the same experience I have. It's not, it just is said differently. And for me, and from what I have understood from some Catholic people, Christian people, prayer is not different from sitting for them. I always tell the story about Mother Teresa, which some of you maybe heard, where the journalist asks her, when she prays, what does she say to God? And she says, nothing, I just listen. And then the journalist says, ah, so what does God say to you when you pray? And she said, nothing, he just listens. That sounds exactly like what we're doing, right? And Mother Teresa was, you know, if she hasn't been already made a saint, she will be, I'm assuming, at some point. Someone very important in the Catholic Church. And yet she's doing the same thing we're doing.
She suffered a lot.
She suffered a lot.
Because she couldn't find God.
Yep. And as St. John of the Cross, I don't know, do you know him in Portuguese? Yeah, okay. Who was persecuted and in jail and whatever. And he said, I can see the source that flows freely and constantly, although there is darkness. So even though dark, even though we can't see, even though it seems desperate, we know the source. all that means is I am just this. I'm not trying to get out of the darkness. I want the light. It's just this. This itself is source. This is it. Does that provide some sort of view? I don't know. But it might help you to know that there are a lot of people in your situation. A lot. Not a few. Yeah. But what's important is your experience. It can help to know that other people are experiencing it, but what's important is how you experience
it. Maybe, I don't know, maybe in your daily practice, if you choose the ritual from the image, it can help you to integrate every. Like you can meditate with Christ. It's good also.
Individualization, meditation.
Never think and meditate there.
And in fact, the Dalai Lama said as well that he really recommended that people didn't leave their if they had a practice already, he recommended that they stay with it. But he wasn't trying to make a world of Buddhists.
Mm-hmm.
Unless, of course, they feel that that is their way, in which case that's something different. And again, I've said this to several people. For me, Zen is not Buddhist and it's not a religion. So it can't be defined. There's no problem if someone is a rabbi and goes to a synagogue. And there's no problem because it's not a religion. There's no conflict.
When we spoke about sitting, we also spoke about meditation. And for me, it's not yet clear what is different and more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think maybe you weren't here the day when
I
mentioned it.
I was not.
Okay.
It was not clear.
I understand. I usually just say sitting, because meditation for me involves a separation of subject and an object. And actually, the French-Tibetan monk Matthieu Ricard said that the translation, the word that we've translated from Sanskrit and Pali into Western languages, we translate as meditation, actually would be more appropriate to say becoming familiar with, becoming intimate with. Rather than meditating on, it's to become familiar, intimate, to become one with, which eliminates that separation of, or it's a process of eliminating a separation. Whereas meditation seems to maintain that separation. I am meditating on something. It might be I am meditating on me, but that's still a separation. So when I say sitting, it's just sitting. There's no other activity, and sitting doesn't involve, hey, I can say I am sitting. It sounds, we can interpret that as I am doing something. But in fact, our experience of it is just sitting. We're trying to bring our awareness. We're trying to be present. Of course, we have a lot of effort we're making. But that effort is, like Matthieu Ricard said, it's going towards eliminating the separation rather than maintaining it. Or feeding it, feeding the separation.
One thing is still confusing is that does it mean that it exists sitting and meditation?
and then we can do sitting, or that we can do meditation. Or that means that meditation was not the right word, and indeed what we do and what we shall do is only sitting.
Mm. Yes and no. Yes, you could say there are two different things. There are some traditions, maybe, that I don't know. I don't teach in a different tradition, so I don't really know what other schools would say about meditation. Others have different techniques as well. You know, the example, which you all know very well, of the Tibetan tradition where there are visualizations and mantras. I don't use that. Now, I don't know if the Tibetans would call that meditation. Or I don't know what they call that. It doesn't matter so much. But
they
have a different technique for doing that, but they use the same word. The problem is the word, you know, meditation. Because the Western mind functions in a certain way, we have certain words for things that in Tibetan or Sanskrit or Pali or Japanese, they don't have. In Japanese, you call it zazen, which literally means sitting. You sit. Okay? And the Japanese don't have any problems that they understand what that means. It doesn't necessarily mean that they all have the experience of being completely here now, but they understand what that means. Whereas in the West, we don't understand. It's a different culture. It's a different way of being. So the word that we have, as you say, the problem is with the word. You know, we're stuck on that, what that means. If we can let go of our idea about what meditation means, then we don't have any problem. We can call it meditation. We could call it sitting. We can call it running. We can call it screaming. It doesn't matter what you call it. You just sit with this. There are different techniques for meditation with different objects and different schools and different groups and things that I don't know about. But in this tradition, that's...
Eu queria saber o que é que o Zen entende por apego e amor. Apego e amor. Queres ver o que é que o Zen...
Amor. Amor.
Yeah, I
would
like to know what
more.
Well, okay, I want to know what in Zen is meant by
attachment
and what is meant by and how you look upon love.
Do you mean attachment in regards to love, or is this two separate questions? Two separate questions. Because it's interesting because we often confuse the two. Confuse attachment to love. But I will address them as you then want them. Attachment is what we've been talking about, being stuck. Being caught. Grasping, seizing things. We become attached to waking up at 6:30 in the morning, or we become attached to not wanting to wake up at 6:30 in the morning, or we become attached to an object that we have, a nice watch or a ring. And attachment to an idea about ourselves. I am not smart. I am sensitive. I'm not sensitive. I'm slow. We become attached to things we want. I want to accomplish this. I'm attached to goals. Actually, we become attached to anything and everything at every moment. And this practice is just about and in Buddhism, when we talk about attachment, that's what we're talking about. And the practice is just about letting go. You know, it's like having this in your hand and then dropping it. It doesn't mean that I don't appreciate this ring. My husband gave me this ring, and I like this ring. Of course, I would feel something if I lost it. I would be sad if I lost this ring because my husband gave it to me and I really like it. Can I let go anyway, knowing that? Because the reality is, the equivalent of losing this ring is, I will die. You know, I'm very attached to my life. And I will die. Both. So, the non-attachment, the letting go, involves just appreciating what's here now and not attaching to how long it will be here, what it will look like tomorrow, what it looked like yesterday. Yesterday the sky was free of clouds. The sky was just blue, not a cloud in the sky until later in the day. Today, there's a lot of clouds. If I was attached to my pleasure yesterday, I would be very unhappy today because the sky is different. And that is every moment. That same thing happens every moment. I'm attached to how it is and I want it to stay. Or I don't like how it is and I want it to change. So that's the notion of attachment. Of this basic delusion that we can control, that we can hang on to things, that things are permanent.
When you a person lost his mother or someone special for them, and they want to die with them, that's attachment or love?
See, I told you that they got mixed up. We mixed them up, huh? I knew that there was something there. There is an attachment there to some idea of love and some idea of life and death. I can't say exactly what it is because we're not in that. It's just a situation we're saying if it's like this. But what I can see in that situation is an attachment to love, to what love is and how I should express love and how I can experience love, and also an attachment to an idea about life and death. If that one died and I love that one, I can no longer live without that one, or because I love that person so much, I have to die too. I don't know what it is, but things like that. I said often we confuse, not often, but it's common to confuse love and attachment. We think that if we love someone, we have to possess them. Or if someone loves me, they control me, or they possess me. In fact, that's the opposite of love. My experience is that everything is love. Everything is just an expression of love. Even hate is an expression of love that is not satisfied, not realized, not fully expressed, not being allowed to freely flow. Everything is love. Can you define that? Can you define love? No, but you can experience it. And you can feel it. And the less you have an idea about it, the more you can feel it. And if you truly love someone, you see that that person is entirely who he is. And you can see that you are entirely who you are. And that person is entirely free, and you want that person to be free, and you want that person to fully be himself. You don't need to control them. That's true. And, for example, with a child, if you truly love that child, then you are able to know when to say no. You can't do that. You can freely love them however it's called upon to be. Because you love them, you will do that for them. Because you love them, you will fulfill your role as a parent, and you will do it. Because in a Zen retreat, because I love you, I will maintain the schedule. I will give you the structure. I will do everything I can to help you realize who you are. If I didn't care, if there was not love, none of this would happen. But that's the expression, an expression of love. Everything is an expression of love. Even attachment is an expression of love. However, we're not aware of it. And we then, as soon as we're not aware of something, it becomes twisted. And even the twist is an expression of love. It's just a twisted expression of love.
This part of attachment and
can we be provided?
Which part of attachment?
You're saying that everything is an expression of love. I mean, in that sense,
and then even attachment.
And only if we are aware, then it's an expression of love. But if we are not,
it's still an expression of love, but we're not aware of it. It's like we are all potential. We are all Buddhas, but we're not aware of it. I'm trying to give an example. It's more because I have this delusion about myself and the other. I think the other is outside, is separate, and I think that he will make me feel more whole or more complete. He will solve all of my problems. Right? So I need to control him and possess him so that he will do that for me. Or I need to keep him away just at a certain how I think it should be so that he will do that for me, or so that he won't invade this space for me. This is an expression of a love for myself, for an idea of myself. And that's love as well. It's not, there's nothing that is not love in that sense. It's a twisted version of it that is also an expression of love. And so when we're, you know, when I'm saying the attachment, you become very attached to, I become attached to my ring. Very attached to this ring. Because I love this ring. But to truly love it is maybe to not be so attached to it. To let it be, you know, to fully appreciate it for what it is, and not have to constantly know exactly where it is. Because if you have this experience of boundlessness of your being, there's nothing outside it. And the same, and that is love. Love is boundless. There's nothing that is not it. And I think is it three? No, I'm out of time. One last thing that just came to me when I was talking about this. I also did a peacemaking retreat in Jerusalem a few years ago. In Jerusalem. And the same thing, there were people from different traditions, and we met with a lot of Palestinians and Jews, and we were all mixed together. And at one point, we were having a tour of the city and looking around of the old city of Jerusalem, which is walled in. And Jerusalem is quite big apart from that, but the old city is walled in. And we were standing on one of the gates, the Lion's Gate, Western Gate, something. And from there you could see the view of the Mount of the Olives. And someone mentioned the Mount of the Olives to me this morning, and I remember the story. And so the tour guide was telling us this story about Christ and whatever. And I didn't know this story before because I didn't have it there. I had a formal Christian education, but I never believed what they were telling me because they didn't really believe what they were telling me. So how could I do it? Even as a child, I thought it. You know. Or they weren't embodying what they were telling me. I could see right through it, even as a child. So I didn't know. And so there was a story where I think the night before the guards came to get Christ and take him away to be crucified, he was standing on the Mount of the Olives and looking at the city. And weeping. And saying, poor Jerusalem. Poor Jerusalem. This is an expression of his love, and it's also his expression of seeing how they're hurting themselves, and they still are today. We could still stand on the Mount of Olives and look at Jerusalem and say, poor Jerusalem. It's our ignorance, it's our delusion of this separation. I am different from you. They're brothers, the Jews and the Arabs. They come from the same blood. It's brothers killing brothers. However, the same thing is happening everywhere. We're all one. We're all one body. And yet we're all killing each other. It's crystallized in certain places, Jerusalem. So Christ looking there and saying, poor Jerusalem, poor Jerusalem, he has this enormous compassion because he knows what that suffering is. He knows. He knows what it's like to feel separate, the need to destroy the other so that I can feel good about myself, to have a right way and a wrong way, right beliefs and false beliefs. I don't remember why I thought of that story, but it fits with the notion of it's all one. If you don't want to leave the Zendo, don't come in the Zendo.
Going with it.
Yeah, being wrong.
Knowing,
yeah.
with that. Mm-hmm. Because you can, I can imagine, you can feel it, and you can see it, you can experience it, and not coming with it.
Mm-hmm. Yet that involves being, again, letting go, again, of jumping off the pole. And like a parent knowing when to say no. Just being with what it is. If we are just experiencing what we are experiencing, it will never be too much. It's when we start having ideas about what we should do and should not do, that then we start getting caught up and it can be overwhelming. But if we just experience what it is, then there's no problem. We're just here now, then there's no problem. Nothing is too much, okay? Nothing will happen to you that you can't handle. You think it will. And sometimes you feel, you know, yesterday, last night, I had to just sit. I thought I will continue with the interviews last night, but no. I said, okay, no. I know this is the limit. I need to stop. I need to just sit. I could have been caught up in my, no, I need that. They need to speak. I need to be there for them. I need to do this. I had to drop that belief and just sit. Fine. Nobody had any problem with that, did they? I mean, and if they did, well, then it is. So it really involves being so close that there's nothing off. Everything is right here.
I don't know if I explained it very well. Someone told me this two or three months ago, and an episode of the Bible, and Christ. It was explained to me that the Bible shows you that there is no, in a way, that there is a part that is for the race. I don't know if this is true. Mm. And when Christ is on the cross, there is a part where he has to the sky and asks to his father, why did you abandon me?
Mm-hmm.
And there is no answer.
Mm-hmm.
He said there is a depth where there is an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And God answer is not here. For abandoning you. But I never asked you to suffer for the others, to carry that cross. I always ask you to live in love, to spread love.
Mm-hmm.
I never asked you to carry the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And suffering, just as to live in love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they want.
Mm-hmm.
We are carrying that suffering, that
mm-hmm.
cross.
Mm-hmm.
And no one asks.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if this is true, but when he told me that, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not much repeated.
I'm so sorry.
Sim, eu percebi que parte me abandona, me abandonaste.
E eu disse, há um texto que está a ser apagado ou destruído ou que desapareceu, em que Deus responde ao fim. Diz, eu nunca te abandonei, mas eu também nunca te pedi para carregar a cruz dos outros, o sofrimento dos outros. E eu te pedi para viver em amor e para espalhar a sua.
And I don't know, you know, it's possible that it's in the Gospel of St. Thomas, which is considered not official by the Church as well.
Yeah.
But in any case, this is very interesting because, in fact, Christ... Perhaps it's as a, you know, I think when Christ asked that question, as I said before, we often ask questions that we already know the answer to. And in fact, my experience with Christ, and I know of his teachings, he already knew the answer. He already knew that he was not, there was not I and the other, and I am carrying the burden of the other's suffering. He knew that it was one. And so when we say he was dying for us, it was to show us that. I mean, you can interpret it as that. For love. Yeah. Okay, I think it's way past lunchtime. So we should go eat.